From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Supreme Court issued some eagerly awaited decisions today on gerrymandering and on whether a citizenship question can be included in the 2020 census. We'll talk about the gerrymandering decision in just a few minutes, but first, the census decision. The justices ruled that for now, a question about citizenship will be blocked from the 2020 census form. Joining us now is NPR's Hansi Lo Wang, who's been covering this story. Hi, Hansi.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this is a complicated decision. Explain exactly what happened here, because Chief Justice Roberts wrote for the majority in what is being called a defeat for the Trump administration.
Right. This is a very, very complicated opinion that was issued today. It took me a while to figure it out. I think the thing to take away from it is that for now, the citizenship question that the Trump administration wants to add to the 2020 census, a question that asks, is this person a citizen of the United States? That question remains blocked from being added to the 2020 census forms. And a majority of the court, led by Chief Justice John Roberts, found that essentially, and you know, this is a quote, he said that, you know, the court cannot ignore the disconnect between the decision made and the explanation given by the Trump administration for the citizenship question. So we have to remember back, the Trump administration has said they wanted this question in order to better protect part of the Voting Rights Act, specifically protections against the discrimination of racial and language minorities by using the citizenship question. But through the trial, the plaintiffs argued that this would not help better protect the Voting Rights Act, and adding the question would not be the way to provide more accurate citizenship information that the Trump administration wanted. And so now the court here is saying that it appears that this explanation by the Trump administration is a contrived reason, and that is the reason why they are officially sending this decision back to a lower court for the Trump administration's, the Commerce Department, which oversees the Census Bureau, to review again. And again, this means this question is still blocked for now, but we'll have to see and watch how this plays out, because this has been a very complicated legal case.
Well, so what does that mean for now? The Census Bureau has said that it needs to begin printing the census forms on July 1st, which is next week. So what do we know about the timing here?
Right. We are days away from when the Census Bureau says that printing has to start. 1.5 billion paper forms, letters, mailings have to be printed on time according to schedule. And the big concern has been, could the Census Bureau have this final word? And right now, we're not quite sure what the final word is. I checked in with the Census Bureau, asked them how they're interpreting this Supreme Court's decision. They say they are still reviewing this decision. So we don't know yet what will happen quite yet. Whether those forms will be printed with or without a citizenship question starting on Monday.
Well, and remind us about the consequences of this. This is not just about a question on a piece of paper. This would have really far-reaching consequences if you were to ask the question of whether somebody is a citizen when they answer the census.
Right. This is a question that the Census Bureau has long considered a very sensitive question, a type of question when asking about citizenship status could really harm the accuracy of the national headcount. And it's important to remember that the Constitution calls for a headcount of every person living in the U.S., not every U.S. citizen. And so it does not matter about citizenship status. It doesn't matter about immigration status. And the Census Bureau has tried to meet the goal of doing that headcount by avoiding things that would make it hard to do that headcount, that would discourage households with non-citizens from participating. And just a newly released paper from the Census Bureau researchers found that around 9 million people, an estimated 9 million people, could be discouraged from participating in the headcount if the citizenship question is included on the 2020 census.
Well, and if people are discouraged, then the consequence of that is that congressional maps get drawn and they're not accurate because they're not showing these apparently 9 million people who didn't answer the census.
Right. When we're talking about the census, we are really talking about power and we're talking about money. This is how we determine how political representation and federal funding are distributed around the country to states, to local communities. The census numbers determine how congressional seats are reapportioned among the states and electoral college votes are reapportioned among the states, as well as how an estimated $900 billion a year in federal funding for schools, for roads, for other public services are distributed to everyone's local community.
Okay. So, Hansi, briefly, let me just get to another part of this story, which is that there are these materials that recently turned up when Thomas Hoffler, who's a Republican strategist who died, his estranged daughter turned over his hard drive and lawyers found a document that explained that putting a citizenship question on the census would give Republicans an advantage in drawing legislative districts. Is that development going to affect what happens next?
Those are documents. These Thomas Hoffler files are part of an ongoing battle in the lower court in New York, where Trump administration officials have been accused of being part of a cover-up for what plaintiffs here are saying was the real reason for this question, which is to give Republicans and non-Hispanic whites, a political advantage during redistricting by using citizenship information. So we'll see how that plays out later this summer.
That's Hanzilo Wang of NPR. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, in another 5-4 decision today, the court ruled that considering partisan redistricting or gerrymandering, this is drawing voting maps to favor one party over the other, even considering that case is not in their job description. The court was actually asked to consider two cases, one challenging maps made by Republican lawmakers in North Carolina, another maps drawn by Democrats in Maryland, the challengers saying the districts were carved up to favor the carvers. But the court today let the maps stand. Chief Justice John Roberts, writing in the majority opinion, we conclude that partisan gerrymandering claims present political questions beyond the reach of the federal courts. He also wrote, our conclusion does not condone excessive partisan gerrymandering, nor does our conclusion condemn complaints about districting to echo into a void. Let's bring in NPR's Miles Parks. Miles, we're reminded that the court already ruled in 2017 on racial gerrymandering. This is carving out districts in ways that hurt minorities. You cannot do that, the court said. But here, they didn't want to rule and therefore upheld partisan gerrymandering. Tell us more about how these cases got there.
Right. So this is two cases, as you mentioned, Robin. One out of North Carolina, where the state legislature, North Carolina is a state that's pretty evenly broken up 50-50 between Democrats and Republicans. But the congressional representation there is 10-3 Republicans. In Maryland, it's the opposite. Democrats control the government. And basically, the plaintiff said that the government drew maps to push out a longtime incumbent Republican House member. And what's interesting here is these were extreme cases, not only by statistical analysis in terms of how votes were divvied up to favor politicians, but in just how open the politicians were about their intent. In North Carolina, there was a famous quote from a lawmaker where he basically said, the only reason we didn't draw it so that that way there were 11 Republicans in power is because we couldn't figure out how. And Maryland, the same thing. Former Governor Martin O'Malley was very open about that district, him wanting to turn it to a Democratic district.
Well, so we have the court's decision that this isn't their job. Justice Elena Kagan wrote the rebuttal. She read part of it from the bench, saying, in giving such gerrymanders a pass from judicial review, the majority goes tragically wrong. So serious disagreement here. Tell us more about the case she made.
Well, the case she made is the case that a number of advocate groups have been making for years now. I mean, the Supreme Court has punted on this issue for decades, mostly because they said there wasn't a good standard, despite there being a lot of statistical analysis over the last decade that's come out on ways that not only can you prove exactly how the legislators have done it to advantage themselves, but they can really zero in on intent. And so even though there are these advanced statistical ways that you can get at this question, the judges in the majority decided not to rule on it, and they have continued that trend from decades ago.
Yeah. Well, look, these things count. For example, in Maryland, where Democrats came into power and redrew the maps that they claimed were rigged against them, before the change, the Republican representative, Roscoe Bartlett, won his 2010 race by 28 points. In 2012, after the Democratic redistricting, Representative John Delaney, he's now a presidential candidate, won by 21. So some would argue these things really count. We heard Chief Justice Roberts write that our conclusion that this doesn't belong in the Supreme Court that doesn't condemn complaints about districting to echo into a void. But if not the Supreme Court weighing in on this, who?
Well, so there's two routes here. There's state courts can still weigh on this issue on whether gerrymandering violates state constitutions. The other thing that John Roberts mentioned is the possibility for legislation, either at the state level or by Congress federally, mandating that partisan gerrymandering is not something we want. I think it's interesting. John Roberts is not pretending in his opinion that gerrymandering is something that benefits democracy. He says specifically that the practice is reasonably actually unjust. It's just that he doesn't think the court has a place to do it. He says, he mentions that Congress has drafted a number of bills that would address this issue. We should say, however, it doesn't seem that any of those bills have a reasonable chance at passage, considering just how hard it is to get any election legislation through the federal Congress. At the state level, it is more realistic. We have seen states take action through citizen initiatives in a number of states to actually institute independent redistricting commissions to take over this process away from the partisan elected officials.
Well, boy, to hear a Chief Justice say, you know, we do think this is unjust and then not act on it is going to rub some people the wrong way. But meantime, very briefly, Miles Parks, do those maps stand?
They do stand, mm-hmm. and the other states that were relying on this decision, they're also going to stand there. And it's interesting, you look ahead to 2020, you could see legislators drawing even more extreme partisan gerrymanders.
NPR's Miles Parks, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
Next, as in a beauty pageant or a spelling bee, the first batch of contestants are exiting stage right. The next batch takes the stage tonight in Miami in the two-part first round of debates for the Democratic presidential nomination. So how did it go last night? Well, first, let's name the candidates. As writer Susan Orlean tweeted out halfway through, I've said, who is that, 5 times. So left to right, Bill de Blasio, Tim Ryan, Julian Castro, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren.
And then Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar, Tulsi Gabbard, Jay Inslee, and John Delaney. Let's bring in Bloomberg national political reporter Sahil Kapoor. He's in Miami, where last night's debate was held. Hi, Sahil.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by AP national politics reporter Meg Kinnard from Columbia, South Carolina, one of the big early states. Hi, Meg.
Hello, good to be with you.
Okay, so first let me just ask each of you what your first impressions were from last night. Sahil, what's the headline from the debate?
We wrote a piece about how Elizabeth Warren emerged largely unscathed on the first night of the Democratic debate. She was the only candidate in the top 5 in the Democratic polls to be on this stage. And there were a number of skirmishes between her lower polling rivals. We saw Amy Klobuchar and Jay Inslee go at it. We saw Julian Castro and Beto O'Rourke go at it. But nobody at any point turned to Warren and really challenged her on much of anything. And she got to kind of steer the debate in the direction that she's very comfortable with on her turf, on issues like income inequality and busting corporate power. So on the whole, it was a decent night for her, although she did kind of set a trap for herself in the general election if she does become the nominee.
Because we went pretty far to the left on some issues, including
on Medicare for All.
And getting rid of private health insurance. Meg, what's your headline from last night?
This really was an opportunity for Elizabeth Warren to stand out, and that she did. There were plenty of points of contention and conversation with some of the lower polling rivals. For those folks, they're really trying to find that moment to stand out from this massive field. Elizabeth Warren isn't in that position. She already stands out in polling and fundraising and in being in center stage last night. So it certainly was an opportunity for others to try to get some of that spotlight from her and for her to really occupy most of that space. There were actually several campaigns that were tweeting during the debate saying that their candidates hadn't been getting nearly as much time as Elizabeth Warren, name-checking her specifically and pointing out that they didn't think that it had really been a fair allocation of time. But there were many of instances where these candidates and campaigns were interrupting each other and sometimes trying to turn that conversation back to whatever topic Elizabeth Warren had been asked about and trying to get a little bit of that attention themselves.
Well, and it's funny because people, of course, were tracking, and it felt to me as if Senator Cory Booker and former Secretary Julian Castro got a lot of time.
Well, Booker got the most.
Yeah,
it looks like
most.
10:53.
Yeah, and you know, de Blasio, Jay Inslee, not very much. So it was very uneven. But just given that, was there somebody who busted out to either of you?
On the issue of immigration, I think Julian Castro had a good night. He made his argument pretty compellingly. He threw some elbows at his rival, specifically Beto O'Rourke, fellow Texan. He was the only one on stage who supports a policy of decriminalizing migration. Mm-hmm. In other words, changing a provision of the law that says if you cross the border, yes, we can, you know, yes, there will be an infraction for it, but it won't be a crime. And that's a very far-reaching change that has some support among progressive activist. Cory Booker, as you mentioned, I believe he was the most searched candidate on Google on the night of the debate, which is a remarkable achievement.
Actually,
because
I think Tulsi Gabbard, Fox was reporting that Tulsi Gabbard was at one point the
Excuse
most
me.
Searched.
Okay. Yeah, I may have been looking during the debate or immediately after, and Tulsi Gabbard might have overtaken him. But yeah. Booker certainly got some airtime, quite a bit of airtime to talk about issues like gun control. He spoke about it in personal terms, that he grew up in a neighborhood where this happened. And being an African-American man himself, he had to, you know, he had to look around him and make sure he was feeling safe in his own neighborhood.
Well, and I believe he still lives in the projects in Newark.
He talks about it very frequently on the trail as well.
A friend killed on the street. That was very compelling. Yeah. So to you, Meg, somebody who just, wait, I didn't expect that.
Well, Castro, for sure, as already mentioned, stood out in the debate over immigration and repeatedly went after several of the other campaigns in terms of do you support his same stance on decriminalizing those border crossings. I think another candidate that we maybe haven't seen as much out on the trail or heard from as much, particularly in some of the early states, was Mayor de Blasio. He did adopt somewhat of an aggressive stance, a bullish stance, and made it clear how he felt about certain issues, including gun violence. We mentioned Senator Booker and his own personal experience with dealing with some of those issues. But for Mayor de Blasio, he noted last night that he is raising a black son. Mm-hmm. And so there are certain issues dealing with guns and violence and racial issues in particular that he's had to approach from a different standpoint and was able to give that voice to the debate last night.
Let's talk about some of the candidates who didn't want to go that far to the left or even wanted to point out, like Tim Ryan, the representative from Ohio, that the Democrats do that at their own peril, that they need to appeal to people in the middle. This is Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, asked about her past comments that plans to make college free for everyone were unrealistic.
I do get concerned about paying for college for rich kids. I do. But I think my plan is a good one. And my plan would be to, first of all, make community college free. And make sure that everyone else besides that top percentile gets help with their education.
Sahil, what did you make of the candidates, and I would include Beto O'Rourke in that as well, as he got into a debate about immigration, that wanted to make sure that they're thinking about that general election and appealing to people in the middle?
There were several candidates on that stage who tried to appear more pragmatic, who cut a more moderate profile than the kind of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, AOC wing of the party. Klobuchar was one of them, and we saw this most prominently in the debate on health care. Amy Klobuchar and John Delaney and Beto O'Rourke made the case against single-payer health care, also known as Medicare for All. Klobuchar, I'm quoting here, "I'm just concerned about kicking half of Americans off their health insurance in just 4 years," unquote. Elizabeth Warren, on the other hand, her hand shot up, as did Bill de Blasio's, mm-hmm. on the question of whether she supports eliminating private insurance. And this is a major split, I think, that symbolizes this big debate within the Democratic Party between the insurgent left and the more pragmatic wing.
Let's talk about Warren for a second. And I can hear the followers of the other nine saying no, because, you know, she, you know, is so talked about and was the highest ranked in the polls last night. But I'm wondering if each of you felt that she got to some of the specifics or was she maybe too broad brush? Here she is. Let's see. Here she is. This was, again, about health care. She and Bill de Blasio, you know, only two candidates, as you said, who raised their hands. And I'm going to back up. Hold on. I'm looking for that. Yeah, here she is. She's talking about one of her campaign key messages about inequity and, you know, government has to get involved in fixing the economy. Let's listen.
When you've got a government, when you've got an economy that does great for those with money and isn't doing great for everyone else, that is corruption, pure and simple. We need to call it out. We need to attack it head on. And we need to make structural change in our government, in our economy, and in our country.
Now, polls show that those lines seem to be working for her. But did either of you feel that she could have gone deeper? I mean, she's talking about, when she talks about a wealth tax, it's on people, it's on after the first $50 million, you know, getting some of these specifics across?
Right. One of the things that's become kind of a refrain for Elizabeth Warren throughout this campaign is she's got a plan for that. And that was referenced last night as well. She has plans to combat many ills that she sees as part of our nation's structure at the moment. But there was a lot of kind of overarching, broad-based information coming from Elizabeth Warren last night. And you're right. I mean, she talked more about this thinner and thinner slice at the top of the economy that's benefiting, whereas the most of the people down towards the bottom aren't. Yes, that's something she hits at a lot on the trail, but really, you know, drilling down into some of those policies that she has rolled out. You referenced the ultra-millionaire tax. That's something that she talked about extensively here during several trips to South Carolina. But really getting down into the brass tacks, I mean, some of that information is something that people can kind of glaze over in debates, right? I mean, there are 10 people on stage. They only have 2 hours. That breaks down into not very much time per person. So I would imagine that a lot of campaigns don't want to spend the very little time they have really throwing out a lot of numbers at people. Mm-hmm. But at the same rate, hearing some of those details is something that, at least for the voters who are beginning to pay attention at this point, they're going to want to start hearing pretty soon.
Okay. Entonces, es necesario que we talk about the Spanish speaking that happened last night. Here's a little montage we put together.
Necesitamos incluir cada persona en nuestra democracia. Cada votante necesitamos la representación y cada voz necesitamos escuchar.
La situación ahora es inaceptable. Este presidente ha atacado, ha demonizado los inmigrantes. Es inaceptable y voy a cambiar esto.
Me llamo Julián Castro y estoy postulando por presidente de los Estados Unidos.
Okay, so that's Cory Booker, Beto O'Rourke, and Julian Castro.
Sahil, I think Marianne Williams tweeted out last night, I have to learn Spanish by tomorrow.
Right, but we have to remember that this was also broadcast on Telemundo, that there are tens of millions of people in this country who speak Spanish probably more often than they speak English. Was that a smart move for these candidates to do that, Sahil?
The debate was in Miami. There were almost certainly plenty of Spanish speakers in the crowd. You mentioned it was broadcast in Telemundo. Many Spanish speakers watching. The Democratic Party is increasingly reliant on a growing base of Hispanic voters, for many of whom Spanish is a first language. So absolutely, it makes sense for these candidates to try to speak to them directly in Spanish, as a number of the candidates, starting with Beto O'Rourke, went out of their way to do.
And Meg, just quick, 30 seconds. I feel we saw 10 people last night, whatever you think of them, who had a lot of substance.
We did. Certainly, there are a lot of choices here in the field. There's a broad range. And last night, we really were able to hear for the first time on the same stage, speaking at the same time, a lot of the opportunities to contrast some of the different ideas that these campaigns have. So there are a lot of choices for voters, that's for sure.
Well, I say as an East Coast resident, I wish they could do these a little earlier so we could go to bed, but we got to do it for the West Coast. Sahil Kapoor and Meg Kinnard, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Norway plays England today in the first quarterfinal match in the Women's World Cup. The U.S. women play the host team France tomorrow. Let's check in with Mike Pesca, here and now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So we'll all, of course, watch the game between Norway and England, but the U.S. v. France is the match everyone wanted this tournament. Why?
The two best teams, the reigning champions, the French are the host team. It has everything.
Yeah, and so it's kind of a shame this isn't the championship game.
You know, on the one hand, you could say that FIFA should get out of its own way and schedule a tournament so that the two best teams, and everyone knew they were the best teams going in, don't have to play for at least the semifinals. On the other hand, you know, this is how the draw went, and we don't always get a perfect draw. And in the sports that have been doing it a long, long time, longer than even the Women's World Cup, you often get the two best teams not meeting in the finals. Yeah, so let's give them a little bit of a pass.
And just quick, what do you see? The U.S. struggled, although they did beat Spain, but they struggled.
Yeah.
France, better team than Spain. What do you think?
No team looks great in this World Cup. I'm not seeing dominance out of anyone. I will say the odds makers after France and the United States were co-favorites. The United States have become big, big favorites. They're kind of down on France. So United States right now is 50-50 to win the whole tournament.
Yeah. Well, what about other quarterfinals?
Well, I think that the Italians, obviously a fantastic soccer culture, but they haven't been a great women's team for a while. So that's going to be interesting. Mm-hmm. I do think there's two things going on. One is that I think the skill levels of many of the players have condensed so that there's not these huge gaps in skill that we used to see 4 or 8 years ago. And soccer is just a game with a high variance. And, you know, one or two kicks or bad saves determines everything. So cliche as it is, I think it's fairly wide open and could go any way.
Okay. And what would sports be without a controversy? Let's just mention this one. This week, President Trump fired off a series of tweets criticizing the American star Megan Rapinoe after that old video surfaced in which she said she would not be going to the, it's okay, I'm not going to say it, blankety-blank White House. Your thoughts on the squabble?
Yeah, this was an old video. I don't know that Donald Trump knew it was an old video. We haven't reported out what his understanding was. It's likely that he just saw it and chafed. And as a famous counterpuncher, he lashed out and said that, oh, the rest of the team will be invited, win or lose. Actually, he didn't say she wouldn't be invited. But, you know, he chafed and he got very upset because Megan Rapinoe has been one of the more vocal critics, not only of the administration, but she's very socially conscious. She was the first, she's the first white woman athlete to take a knee. I think she was the first white athlete overall to take a knee during the national anthem. She did that as a member of the Seattle Club. She had a little bit late in life political awakening. She's a member of the LGBT community. She's very vocal and very active about that. And I do have to say, her teammates love her. She is the emotional center of the team. So I think that Donald Trump will not be getting in the heads of these women.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
President Trump is in Japan, in Osaka, today for the start of the G20 summit, a trip that will also include a visit to South Korea. After the summit ends on Saturday, he'll meet with South Korea's president and visit U.S. troops there. But first, to this G20 meeting where trade and geopolitical tensions are expected to dominate. NPR's Michael Sullivan is there. He's in Osaka. Michael, broadly speaking, what's on the agenda?
Well, the official themes of this year's G20 include bolstering trade and investment, harnessing tech innovation, and combating climate change and pollution. But the real action is expected on the sidelines in bilateral meetings between world leaders, and there's a lot of them. President Trump's meeting with China's President Xi Jinping looms largest, I think, with the two countries locked in their apparently escalating trade war. And then, of course, there's also Iran and North Korea.
Yeah, to be a fly on that wall with the president and President Xi Jinping, Huawei, the Chinese company, and the Trump's ban on their products in the U.S. I mean, what else do you think they might talk about?
Well, they're probably going to talk about whether they're going to get a deal and whether or not they're going to. We don't really know yet. There's no concrete signs. In fact, just before President Trump left to come here Wednesday, he made a point of telling Fox News it's possible that a deal could be reached and the trade war. But if not, he said he was fully prepared to go ahead with more tariffs on Chinese products if it doesn't happen. He wants a new deal, he says, will level the playing field with China in terms of concerns over intellectual property, forced technology transfers, etc. And he's been pretty adamant about sticking to that. So I think it's still an open question, but it's still early. I mean, the meeting between these two men won't come until Saturday. And there's still room and still time for some sort of compromise to be reached to resume negotiating on a new trade deal that might satisfy both sides. And frankly, Robin, if there wasn't, I'm not sure they would have announced they would be meeting at all, right?
Yeah, right. Well, the president's also meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin as the U.S. heads into another election, with all our security agencies warning that Russia is still trying to interfere. What can we expect there?
Well, I think we can expect they'll talk about Russian interference in the last election, and Putin will probably be politely asked to stay out of the one that's coming up. I think they'll probably talk about Syria, too, and the Mideast in general, and Iran. And I think the real focus, though, will be on Iran and election interference.
Talk about that, because the UK, France, Germany, all urging Iran to stay in the nuclear deal, they're all still signed on to. Of course, the U.S. is not anymore. What else will be happening with those Iran discussions?
Well, I think it'll definitely come up when President Trump meets German Chancellor Merkel and in his meeting with President Putin, as we said, and with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, too. I think the Europeans in general want to hear more about where Trump is going with pulling out of the nuclear deal with Iran and with these latest sanctions. And they're worried about how the downing of the U.S. drone helped escalate tension and raise the possibility of open conflict between the U.S. and Iran that Europe does not want to be part of, does not want to get sucked into.
How do you think President Trump is viewed by these other world leaders at the G20? He's, you know, been talking about how he inherited these terrible, you know, trade deals, imbalanced trade deals with other countries. How is he viewed?
Well, I think at this point, it's what, 2.5 years in? His is a much more unilateral approach than that of previous presidents. And I think it's something they've come to understand and gotten used to, even though he still finds ways of antagonizing allies, the same allies he wants to help him in his trade war with China and his approach on Iran. He's got a trilateral meeting tomorrow with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and India's Narendra Modi, for example, both of whom he's gone after recently on trade. He thinks the U.S. is getting taken advantage of by both countries. So that should be interesting. Let's see how that goes.
Okay, let's see. We'll watch with you. NPR's Michael Sullivan in Osaka, Japan for the G20 summit. Michael, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Well, outgoing British Prime Minister Theresa May is in Japan for the G20 summit. She has resigned and is waiting for her Conservative Party to elect a replacement as party leader. The winner will be the next prime minister. The race is down to two candidates. Boris Johnson, the flamboyant former mayor of London, is running against Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt. May stepped aside after she failed to deliver Brexit, the UK's departure from the EU, and that is a big topic as we find out who is going to replace her. Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Hi, Rob.
Hi there, Jeremy.
So where does this race stand right now between Johnson and Hunt?
Boris Johnson remains the absolute front-runner, firm favourite, despite having had an utterly hopeless campaign so far, trying to avoid media attention, then getting into the media for having a row with his girlfriend that the neighbours heard. I mean, yeah, anything that could have gone wrong has gone wrong. But here's the thing. It doesn't really seem to have damaged him that much in the sense that those who are the electorate, which is a relatively small number, about 160,000 Conservative Party activists, they love him. They love Brexit. They don't care. And they think, bring it on. And in that sense, it's very much like the phenomenon in the United States, where it doesn't matter what President Trump does, the people that like him, his base, it all just bounces off. And it's the same with Boris Johnson, really.
And I've seen some headlines coming across that show that Boris Johnson is ready to leave the EU on October 31st with or without a deal. Is that right? He would leave without a deal.
He's used the words do or die. I mean, it sounds more like a James Bond movie, doesn't it? We will leave, do or die. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, Boris Johnson being Boris Johnson, the very next day he says, but I think the odds are 1,000,000 to 1 that we would leave the European Union without a deal. So you kind of scratch your head for a second here, Jeremy, and you think, hang on a minute. So he's saying we're definitely going to leave on October the 31st, but we're going to do it with a deal. Even though the European Union has said absolutely no way are they renegotiating. So you can see where we are. I'd sort of characterize something else about the debate. You know, if I had to sort of sum it up for someone who hadn't been watching this debate, it goes something like this. So those who've worked with Boris Johnson and know him, former associates, have been saying, you know, this is a man thoroughly unsuited to high office, both in terms of his kind of personality and his grasp of policy. And his supporters have been saying, that's a load of old rubbish. You're just trying to smear him and smear Brexit. And I think that sort of sums it up in a sentence.
And what about Jeremy Hunt? What's his position on Brexit?
So he wants to be the head boy of Brexit. I mean, if I could make a little jibe based on the fact that he's one of those people. He was the head boy at the private school that he went to before going to Oxford University, and he sort of exudes managerial competence. I mean, in many ways, he's offering the same, what many would say as utterly unrealistic policy as Boris Johnson, namely to somehow renegotiate a deal with the EU. If that doesn't work, and if push really comes to shove, for Britain to then leave the European Union without one, even though the government's own economic forecast suggests that that would be fairly disastrous. But the way in which he's trying to sort of distinguish himself for Boris Johnson is to say, look, you know, I'm the sort of the calm, the head boy kind of approach. You'd get a very sort of sober, sensible approach, as opposed to Boris Johnson, who's the sort of flamboyant one. And I guess what's really counting against him is that the Conservative Party members, my goodness, they're depressed, they're down, they're exhausted, they're fed up, they want Brexit, they want excitement, they don't want managerial.
Okay, and I want to ask you about one more thing, because you never know what's going to drive these races for leadership. And one of the stories that's come out is about Boris Johnson and his girlfriend. And I guess there was a big fight that the neighbor heard and the police were called, and he's been trying to stop the coverage of that. But tell us more.
Well, you summed it up pretty neatly. I mean, only in the UK could this happen. I guess it tells you something about the way apartments are built. The walls are too thin. So the neighbours heard him having a row one night with his girlfriend, who is 24 years younger than him, which, by the way, is the difference, I'm told, between President Trump and Melania and between President Macron and his wife. So there you go. Maybe there's a there's a portent there. So, yeah, so the neighbour, who, of course, happens to be of a more left-wing point of view and doesn't like Brexit, called both the police and a newspaper saying, look, you might want to come round. It all sounds a bit heated and a bit testy next door. The police did came. They said that everybody inside was fine, meaning Mr. Johnson and his girlfriend. And amazingly, while Britain has been faced with what is undoubtedly its most profound political crisis since 1945, what is our relationship with Europe, what is our place in the world, what is our economic model, what have we been talking about, whether neighbours should call the police and the newspapers if they hear something like this. I mean, you couldn't make it up. Just when you thought that Brexit couldn't get more surreal in British politics, that notch crazier, we've managed to do it.
See, I've stopped thinking that it can't get crazier, because it seems like every time we talk to you, it does. Rob Watson, BBC political correspondent in London, thank you.
Thank you.
Fifty years ago, Life magazine published an issue that made people sit up straight. The June 27, 1969 issue featured the pictures of more than 200 American troops killed in the Vietnam War in 1 week of combat. 1 week. There was a torrent of response. Some saw it as an anti-war statement. Others saw it as a tribute to the fallen. Here now's Alex Ashlock has the story of one of them.
1969 was a year of transition for the Vietnam War. American troop levels had peaked at more than 500,000. President Richard Nixon was in his first months in office. He spoke to the nation on May 14th.
This is the most difficult war in America's history, fought against a ruthless enemy. I am proud of our men who have carried the terrible burden of this war with dignity and courage, despite the division and opposition to the war in the United States. History will record that never have America's fighting men fought more bravely for more unselfish goals than our men in Vietnam.
Nixon said he would start pulling U.S. troops out of the jungles of Vietnam, but that didn't happen fast enough for more than 11,000 Americans who were killed there that year.
I don't know. I know 1969 wasn't a very good year for us. You know.
That's Chris Hickey Silcox. She was 17 when her 19-year-old brother Jimmy Hickey was killed in Vietnam on May 27th. Chris is sitting at the dining room table in her brother John's house in Weymouth, Massachusetts, just south of Boston. It's a gentle early summer evening. Boats are motoring across the pond outside as she talks.
I remember my mother used to say to me before he passed away, "You're just like your brother Jimmy." And then after he passed away, "You are nothing like your brother Jimmy."
Jimmy Hickey was a Marine private. He died in a mortar attack on his base southwest of Da Nang, a week shy of his 20th birthday. 50 years later, Chris looks back on their life as kids in their Irish-American family.
It was just a normal childhood. Went to school, some skipped school, really nothing. And then his friend passed in Vietnam, and these boys joined up and off they went, and that was the end of childhood.
That friend was David Pitts. He died in Wei during the Tet Offensive in 1968. Jimmy Hickey and five of his friends dropped out of high school a month before graduation and joined the military. Again, his sister Chris.
Remember, these kids grew up, and you still heard a lot about World War II, very patriotic, very, you know. And they joined something that was not even remotely close. You know, it was just, it was a mess. It was a mess.
Chris had skipped school the day the Hickeys got word that Jimmy had been killed. She says maybe she had a premonition. Her older brother John was at work, having lunch, when he found out their brother was dead.
And we used to have a big card game every lunchtime. It was about 10 guys playing. And I remember I was dealing. And I looked up and my father was standing there. I knew. Yeah. Just like that. And he said, "It's Jimmy." I said, "I know."
After a wake that filled the Hickey's house, Jimmy Hickey was buried on June 10th, the day before his sister received her high school diploma. Her brother John remembers the drive to the cemetery.
I just rolled the window down for a second for some reason, because we were stopped at a set of lights, waiting for the lights to change, and I hear them say, "That's Jimmy Hickey's. That's Jimmy Hickey's funeral." You know, just stuff like that just stuck in my ear.
A few weeks later, on June 27, 1969, Life magazine arrived. The cover featured the face of a young American soldier, 20-year-old William Gearing from New York. Over his face, the words, "The faces of the American dead in Vietnam, 1 week's toll." Inside were the names and pictures of 242 men who were killed in Vietnam in just 1 week of combat that year. The Hickeys got the magazine that summer, and 50 years later, Chris chokes up as she turns the faded pages.
All these boys. Look at these beautiful boys. Look at them. And there he is. Yeah, this was a heartbreaker.
There are 11 pages of pictures. It looks like a high school yearbook. Life's editors wrote, "We must pause to look into the faces." Again, John Hickey.
It was awful. But the thing that was awful was watching my mom and father. That's all I did. We just watched them, and it just tore them apart. Unbelievable.
Carol Hickey never recovered from her son's death. She died in 1973, just 4 years later, at 42. She had a broken heart, her family said, and just wanted to be with Jimmy again. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Broken heart, how could you not? You can see the picture of Jimmy Hickey along with others featured in Life magazine 50 years ago today at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.